We're very grateful for your presence with us here tonight. It's very commendable that you're concerned about the Lord and His Word and are willing to come and hear some more comments in regard to it. So thank you so much for your presence. I was speaking last night to Brother Edward, and he said he'd heard these things before. He said, I've read the Bible three times, through the Bible three times, so I've heard them before. Well, these things we're talking about are not new. You heard them before, and of course that's good. In fact, they've been here for 2,000 years, so naturally you've heard about them and know what we're talking about. But we're glad you've come to hear these things, and I hope that we might be able to enlighten ourselves and put together the thoughts that the Lord would have us know as to hit the highlights of what's going on. And by that I simply mean that when the children of Israel approached Jericho, and they were trying to conquer that promised land, you remember that Rahab the harlot was told to put a scarlet cord out her window so that it will mark her house. Well, of course, we're not going to talk much about that or play stories of that kind, because even though they're interesting and important, and certainly we delight to know the Bible stories about those things, there's a cord that runs throughout the entire Bible. That cord starts before the world began. It continues the Old Testament into the New, and that's the cord that we're following. It's a cord that marks God's plan and purposes for us to know and to understand His will. So as we approach our study tonight, that handout, by the way, is a general handout for our entire study, not just for tonight. And if you didn't get a copy, you're welcome to it. I made those copies several years ago. I had a number of them on hand, so they're not the best copies, but I hope you can get some good out of them. And then those who wanted to have detailed notes, which some of you asked for about things we've studied already, I have a few copies here for you if you wish to have those. Details that we have gone into already and will tonight as well. We began earlier to talk about God and about His existence, and we spoke about the creation and how that all things that exist came because God and Jesus performed that creational power they had in the beginning. In fact, Genesis says, in the beginning, God. God is there. He's the author of these things. He's the subject of what we're speaking about as the beginning of all things. And then it says there that we're talking about the material existence that we see around us, of the heavenly bodies, of the earth, of human beings, of everything that's in it. God made it all, and it came from His power and His glory in the very beginning. And from that time, God had, as we mentioned last night, in His mind, in His purpose, in His plans, to send the Savior into the world at a later time. Now, the reason He had to do this and wanted to do that is because He knew men were sin. He prepared ahead of time for that by designing for His Son to come in due time. But when that Son was to come, He had to be identified. He had to know who He was, the circumstances about His coming. So God has taken 4,000 years of time to give us little by little by little details to where we can identify when and where, under what circumstances, how to identify this Savior when He came. There'd be no doubt about it. And there is no doubt at all about who the Messiah was and, of course, is. And that's what we're doing, is tracing this line of God's plans and purposes throughout the Bible as we come down to the Lord's church and the Savior's death on the cross, and eventually to our own present day and where we stand in God's sight. Now, we've studied already about the creation. We've studied about the flood. We've studied about the Tower of Babel. We've talked about Abraham and about his being the one through whom God chose to have a family that would have families that would form a nation. And this great nation, which later on became known as Israel, was a small number among the masses of the world. And God identified these as His chosen people. Now, not chosen, as we'll discover later on. Not discovered because they were more righteous, because they were better, because they were more rich. None of those reasons at all, but because they were the children of faithful Abraham. So the credit goes back to Abraham because he feared God and worked with God. So from that line of descent, Abraham, his son, and his son's sons came into being what we know of as Israel. But before Israel becomes a nation, they were put into slavery for 215 years in Egypt. Now this was 430 years after the promise given to Abraham. Well, they were in slavery for 215 years. They cried to God for their release to go to that land that God had prepared for them to have. And the Bible very plain tells us, as we mentioned last night, that those who lived in the land were not wicked enough yet to be destroyed. God says their wickedness is not yet full. So in due time, they did become so wicked, God desired his people to go and destroy them to inherit this land. He promised them 430 years before that time. And as we mentioned last night too, there was a little baby born in Egypt. He was the third child in this particular family. His name was Moses. God saw fit to allow him to be taken to the family of Pharaoh to be reared, but by his own mother, who was his nurse. And so he was reared in the riches and glory of Egypt, but also with the background, understanding, and insight of the mother who had guided him in the proper path as an Israelite. In due time, he became 40 years of age. We notice where that he had to flee at 40 years over to the land southeast there. And the reason why is because he had killed an Egyptian who was giving trouble to an Israelite. And it was discovered, so he fled for 40 years. And at 80 years old, God called him, says, in effect, I have a purpose for you. Go back to Egypt. He had heard the cry of his people. It's now time for them to be delivered. And you're the one I've chosen to deliver my people. So Moses went back to Egypt. He joined with his brother. And they, in turn, performed, through God's blessings, 11 miracles. And these 11 miracles, the 11th one was that Egypt was going to thrust them out of the land because the firstborn of all the people in the land, including the king too, were going to die that night. And they did. Now this is what we call Passover. The Bible speaks of Passover because this is a place and time when God passed over those who had marked the houses with the blood and they were not harmed. But those who didn't understand God's will, did not mark the houses in such a way, the Egyptians, then their firstborn died. Well, Israel goes across the Red Sea, if we remember the Bible story, and they go to the southeast to a place called Sinai. Now, this took them 50 days to get there. From the time of Passover to the time of what we know of as Pentecost later on was 50 days. It's interesting, and I'll mention this now, but we talk about it later on perhaps. From Passover to Pentecost was 50 days. In the New Testament we find from the death of Christ, which was the death of the Lamb, until Pentecost was 50 days. And that's when the Lord saw fit to establish his church and fulfill all those promises he'd been given to us, as we'll talk about tonight, in the Old Testament. So Moses now has led the people of Israel toward that promised land. And as they are at Mount Sinai, 50 days later, God calls Moses to come up into the mountain and gives him two tables of stone. This is the first time we ever read of God writing, but he wrote with his finger on those tables of stone and gave 10 commandments for the people to obey. Now these 10 commandments, and listen carefully to this, these 10 commandments were not new. Now it was new in that it was written on two tables of stone. God solidified this in 10 direct statements that you read about in Exodus chapter 20. But if you read the next 13 chapters, you'll find that these 10 commandments had so many adaptations to those, they're far, far more than 10. I can give you an illustration of that in just a moment. But one of those was the command in the fourth command, that is the children of Israel were to obey the Sabbath day. Now, who does this 10 commandment law apply to? Listen, if you would, Exodus chapter 31. There he says, beginning with verse 16, wherefore the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations. Who? Children of Israel. Through their generations for a perpetual covenant. It's the sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. And he gave unto Moses, when he had made an end of communing with him upon Mount Sinai, two tables of testimony, tables of stone, written with the finger of God. So these were to apply to the people to whom they were given, not to you and me, but to the Israelites. And it says that here. And then if we get on down to Deuteronomy chapter 5, on down in that chapter, he says, remember that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence with a mighty hand and by a stretched out hand. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. Who's commanded? The ones he's speaking to, which are children of Israel. He did not direct this to you. He did not direct it to anybody else in this entire world at any time in this entire world except the Israelites. So the seventh day law does not apply to us. It applied to Israel and to no one else. But then as we continue to notice, some of these principles that we read in the Ten Commandment law were also found at the Garden of Eden. A number of those were found there. You notice that they had lying, there was jealousy, there was murder, and there was lack of respect for God. And shortly after that, we found that adultery was condemned. So we found a number of things that were in the Ten Commandment law that were also from the Garden of Eden. And those same things are found in Romans chapter 13, New Testament. So the principles of the Ten Commandment law still apply today. Not the Ten Commandment law written on tables of stone. That doesn't apply to us, of course, but the principles that we read there do. Let me tell you one reason why we can say that the Ten Commandment law does not apply to us today. The reason why is because, first of all, it's given to Israel. Then, secondly, there were so many adaptations of this law in the next 13 chapters that do not apply to us, and you'll recognize they don't apply to us. Let me read you some of those. Exodus chapter 21, verse 2 says, if you buy a Hebrew servant, 6 years he shall serve, and the seventh year he shall go out free for nothing. So here it's it has to do with servants and how that you buy them and how that they go free after the 6 years of servitude. And then Deuteronomy 22, verse 5 says, the woman shall not wear that which pertains to a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are abominations of the Lord thy God. And then turn further to Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse 10 and 11. And I was asked this question the other day by someone, and here's the answer I gave them, precisely what he says here. Thou shalt not plow an ox and an ass together. And I've seen this done. In the Middle East, I've seen this very thing done. But it was against God's law. And if that applied today, then those Muslims I saw doing that were wrong. Thou shalt not plow an ox or an ass together. But, still Father, if that applies to us today, then certainly I'm sinning tonight. Because the very next verse sentence says, thou shalt not wear a garment of divers sorts, that is, of woolen and linen together. Now this is cotton and polyester, but I'm wrong if I have a shirt on that has two different cloths in it. So see, there were several things more than this. There were several things like this that were specifically to the Hebrews and not to us. So we don't obey the Ten Commandment law given to Israel. Although the principles of this, many of those, do apply still. But Galatians chapter 3 in the New Testament instructs us even farther, beginning with verse 13. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. Now remember, we're talking about the promise to Abraham in Genesis 12, that he would become the father of a great nation, from this nation would emerge the Messiah. That's the promise we're talking about, given about 1900 years before Christ. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He saith not to seeds as of many, but one. So we're not talking about Israel as a whole. We're not talking about a group at all. We're talking to one, about one person. And the seeds as of many, but as of one, and thy seed which is Christ. So Galatians tells us that what we're talking about, really the essence of that promise, is the coming of Jesus Christ. And it says further, and I say that the covenant that was confirmed before of God in Christ, the law, which was 430 years after, cannot disannul that it should make the promise of none effect. He says this law given didn't take away that promise. The promise was still there. The promise came about, but the law faded away. The law was simply there for a temporary reason. We go further. That it should make the promise of none effect. For its inheritance via the law, it is no more promise. If God's blessings came to the law, then you don't look for anything else. It was fulfilled in the law. He says, I'm the case of all. But God gave it to Abraham by promise. Wherefore then serveth the law? What good is it? And he answers that. It was added because of transgressions till the seed should come to whom a promise was made. So the law was given as a temporary crutch for them to lean on until Messiah came, and the law faded away. But the promise was there, was fulfilled, Christ came, and that's what we were looking for, that's what the Israelites were looking for, and that's what we have found fulfilled today for us. So the Ten Commandment law does not apply to us today, particularly the fourth, even though some of the principles do. Then Moses led the children of Israel for 40 years. And the reason why is because Israel decided that they would disobey God again, as they had done throughout the ages. And they would send spies over to the Promised Land to look it out, see what they would find there, as God allowed them to do. And they came back, the 12 spies did, and only two of them said, "We can do it. God's with us. He gave it to us. Let's take it." But 10 drug the feet. "Oh, no, we can't do it. We're not big enough, large enough. We're like grasshoppers in their sight." So they didn't go over. And God was so angry at the people, he said, "Okay, you're going to wander 40 years in this desert. 1 year for every day the spies were gone." Now, when God tells you something, he means it. And when God gets angry, you can watch out. And you should, because we shouldn't make him angry. We ought to be sure that we're there where God says, because he knows best, far beyond what we think or what we plan for. So they wandered for 40 years. To the point at which they went to the east side of the Jordan River. Moses was taken up into a mountain. He was able to look over the Promised Land below, beautiful, beautiful land. Today you can stand somewhat near where he was, look over and see the Jordan Valley below, the beautiful animals that are grazing, the beautiful green grass, and the fields planted and beyond, the beautiful mountains beyond of Israel. He saw all that, but he couldn't go over because he disobeyed God's law. He was favored by God. He walked with God, but he disobeyed God's law in that God told him on one occasion to speak to the rock. He did more than just speak to it. He struck it. And consequently, God said, "Because of this, you have not sanctified me. You can't go to the Promised Land. You can see it, but not go into it." So Moses died. The Bible tells us nobody knows where he's buried. And then Joshua, one of the two that said, "Let's go and take the land," he began to lead the children of Israel in Moses' place. Did a marvelous job. He led them into the Promised Land, and there they divided the Promised Land among the 13 tribes that Israel now had become. And so the 13 tribes now, after this long period of time, inherit the Promised Land. They're divided among it and to the lands that belong to each of the tribes specifically, and they have received God's promise that he gave to them. The promise was fulfilled. Now I want you to notice, if you would, something about the fulfilling of that promise. In the book of Deuteronomy chapter 9, listen to what it says in verse 6. He says, "Understand therefore that the Lord thy God giveth thee not this good land to possess it for thy righteousness." God says, "I'm not giving you because you're good." He says, "For thou art a stiff-necked people." God knew Israel. The reason Israel was his chosen people was because of Abraham and Abraham's faith to God. So God, through Abraham, gave all these blessings. And that's the reason when in Luke chapter 16, you hear of him speaking about Father Abraham being in his bosom. He's the one that God saw fit to bless Israel with because he was so faithful to God. Now, he tells his father then about the land that was to be theirs and what they were to possess and how they were to possess it. And this is extremely good part. Look at Joshua, if you would, chapter 21, verse 43. "And the Lord gave unto Israel all the land," remember that now, "he gave them all the land which he sware to give unto the fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt therein. And the Lord gave them rest round about according to all that he sware unto their fathers, and there stood not a man of all their enemies before them. The Lord delivered all their enemies which the Lord had spoken unto the house of Israel, all came to pass." Now those last three words, "all came to pass," which simply means what God promised them, he delivered. What God promised them they would have, they had. So they inherited everything God told them they would inherit as far as the land promise is concerned. The Messiah hadn't come yet. They've become a great nation. They've become a nation that started off with 600,000 men from the 70 they originally began with in the land of Canaan. And they were a monstrous nation now. But the point is, he gave them all the land that he promised to give them. As I had not yet come, understand. And then as we look farther on, I want you to notice what Joshua chapter 2 says. Let me see. I believe I want to look at another passage in Joshua first. Joshua chapter 23, beginning with verse 14. Now, this is a long reading. I won't read it all because of time. But in Joshua 23:14, he said, "Behold, this day I'm going the way of all the earth." This is Joshua speaking, the leader of Israel now. And he says that I'm going to pass on. I won't be with you anymore. He said, "God spake concerning you, all come to pass unto you, and not one thing hath failed thereof. Therefore it shall come to pass that as all good things are come upon you, which the Lord your God promised you, so shall the Lord bring upon you all evil things until he hath destroyed you from off the good land which the Lord your God hath given you." So Joshua knows that Israel is going to disobey God again. And they're going to lose this land he gave them. That's interesting, isn't it? He gave them the land, he promised the land to them, but they didn't keep it. The reason they didn't keep it is because they're unfaithful to God. And that's the same thing true with us today. God gives us ultimate promises and blessings and care, protection, guidance. Every way we look, God's presence is here. But when we disobey him, we're like a child that needs a spanking. And he can give the spanking very heartily. Here's what he says in verse 16. "When you have transgressed the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and have gone and served other gods, and bowed yourselves to them, then shall the anger of the Lord be kindled against you, and ye shall perish quickly from off the good land which he hath given unto you." So Israel had the land. It was theirs. They possessed it. The disobeyed God is taken away. I've talked to some Israelites. I've talked to some Arabs many years ago in their land. And there's a conflict then, still is, of course, always has been for the last 4,000 years between the Israelites and the Arabs. And here's what the Arabs told me. But first of all, what the Jews are saying. They're saying, "This is our land. We had this land, it was ours to possess. God gave it to us." And the Arabs retort, and here's what they say: "You're correct. It was your land. But you disobeyed God. You took it away and gave it to us. It's our land." That's the problem today. That's the problem we see between the Jews and the Arabs today. The Arabs claim it, the Jews claim it, the Jews lost it. Now, I've said that to say simply this. Don't for a moment think that present-day Israel are God's people. They're not. They were formed by the United Nations. They were given land by the United Nations in 1948. They had lost that land. The Jews had it, and God is not favoring the Jews anymore. The reason that the Jews were chosen by God is because through that line came the Messiah. They served that purpose, it passed away. Now when something served its purpose today, the wrapper it was in no longer is needed. The Jews served that purpose, God took the land away from them because they disobeyed God. The Messiah has come, they have fulfilled their purpose, and consequently do not expect any more to see the Jews favored as they were to begin with. Then after Joshua passed away, the Bible tells us the elders of the land ruled Israel. And this was because there were these 13 tribes. 12 had land division, and the 13th were the tribe of the judges. And they were people who were led by elders. And that each individual section was led by the elders of that particular part of the land. But then God saw fit to lead Israel for 450 years by judges. Now these judges were men he selected from here and there and there and other places when there was a need. The judge would be raised up by God to serve for a purpose for a length of time. When they served purpose was fulfilled, there was no judge. They didn't need one. And then when there was another problem, he'd raise up another judge. This went on for 450 years until finally Samuel came on the scene. When Samuel came on the scene, the Bible tells us his sons were disobedient to God. The people rebelled against that. They saw that these sons should not be as Samuel was. And so they asked for a king to be over them. And God saw fit to let them have a king. God didn't want it. It was not what he desired, not what they should have had. But nonetheless, they insisted on having it. Samuel told them that you are forsaking God. God told Samuel that forsaking me because they are doing away with me as a king and selecting an earthly king around them. But here's what the people said, beginning with verse 1 of chapter 8 of 1 Samuel. And then we read on down, particularly verse 19. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey Samuel. And they said, nay, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, or all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. They wanted to be like the nations around about them. They were not content to be God's nation, God's people, his chosen people, who are blessed by him, as we've seen over and over and over again from creation. They were not pleased with that. They wanted to be like everybody else. And I'll stop here. We're going to talk on this Thursday and Friday night, more detail. But today we must be cautious, as God's people, not to want to be like everybody else. They have flair. They are elite. They're large in number. They're blessed in material ways. They have pomp and ceremony. That's not what God wants. He wants us to obey him from the heart, as his people, to do precisely what he says, humble ourselves before him. He doesn't do that. They were condemned because of it. So we must beware ourselves as members of the Lord's church to be sure we follow the straight and narrow path and don't venture off into things around us to be like the nations, the sectarians that are around us. But then verse 21 says, and Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he rehearsed them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, hearken to their voice and make them a king. So God gave in. He let them have a king, knowing that he didn't want it. They knew he didn't want it. God knew they shouldn't have it. They were going to have it anyway. And of course, they had a king. You know the story then about David and about his being selected by God to be a future king. But in the meantime, Saul was selected. Saul was a mighty man. In fact, the Bible tells us he was in stature from his shoulders to his head higher than anybody else. He must have been a big man. He was humble. He was a choice man to be the king, and God chose him. But later on, we saw he was built up with jealousy, with pride. He was not humble. He disobeyed God, and God desired to replace him. And after 40 years, God took him down. He died, and David, his son-in-law, took his place. David ruled, as you know the story, for 40 years. And then when David died, Solomon, his son, came on the scene, and he ruled for 40 years. And then after these three kings had served for their period of time, Israel had become, in David's time, the greatest empire, the greatest nation on the earth. It was stronger. Nobody could defeat them. Nobody could touch them. In Solomon's day, they were rich, and they were absolutely supreme as far as where the nations are concerned. In fact, the Queen of Sheba came, and as she saw the wisdom of Solomon, she said, the hat had not been told. And so here we have her being so much impressed by Solomon and the glory of Israel. They had reached their very peak at that time. Then Solomon died. And when Solomon died, he had a son whose name was Rehoboam, as you know the story from the Bible. And Rehoboam was one who was a man who did not listen to those around him. He had his own way. He had his own desire. He was bullheaded and blunt and rude and wouldn't humble himself, wouldn't listen to the people like he should have. And there was another man in the kingdom who was named Jeroboam. And Jeroboam wanted to be king instead of Rehoboam. And there was a conflict between the two. And this conflict ended in that the 10 northern tribes from north of Bethlehem, north of Jerusalem, up to the border in the north, they rebelled and went with Jeroboam and took the name of Israel, and later on, in time to come, became known of as the Samaritans. In the meantime, the southern two tribes, this is Judah and Benjamin, remained faithful to David and to God, and so Israel was divided, 10 northern tribes and 2 southern tribes. This came about somewhere in about 900 B.C., so we notice now then that Israel has existed for a long period of time as God's people, rebellious over and over and over again. Mentioned the other night, they were faithful for one generation, and then someone would arise to lead them off the path into the wrong direction. God would pick them up and give them another chance. They'd fall again over and over and over. In fact, one day I counted the rebellions that they had against God. I don't remember how many it was just now. But over and over and over again, they rebelled against God. He lifted them up and gave them another chance. Well, now they have rebelled to the point at which he's allowed the 10 northern tribes to be conquered by a foreign nation. This is in 721 that this occurred. In the meantime, the Bible tells us that Bethlehem and Jerusalem and the area around them remain faithful to God, these two southern tribes, following the righteous king who was the descendants of David. Now let's see if I can show something off the scene that might help a little bit to understand. Okay, we start off with Moses, come to the Joshua and the Judges, and the various kings we mentioned, to where we find Saul. Well, this thing you've got to do backwards. I can't think straight, but that's backwards. Now let's see. We've got Saul and David and Solomon and Rehoboam. So we come down now to the period of time in which we just discussed in our talking earlier. Now the next we want to look at has to do with what happened following Rehoboam coming on the scene. If you notice, the kingdom was divided. And on the left-hand side, the two tribes took the name of Judah, the two faithful tribes. The other 10 tribes took the name of Israel. We won't take time to go in detail about all of those, of course, because we won't have time to do it tonight, although you can do that if you wish to in time to come. And as we notice the descending kingdom, kings, we notice the date at which, approximately date that they became kings, on down to the point at which eventually in 721, the Assyrians came down and conquered Israel. That is, the northern 10 tribes took them away. There were 9 dynasties, 9 families from which these kings came. There were 19 kings, and then they disappeared. We don't find that group of people anymore. And then on the left-hand side, we find Judah, which is Benjamin, and Judah, the tribe of Judah. And eventually they became known as the Jews. And the word Jew is not used before this period of time. So the Jews now are the ones who come on the scene, and the name comes on the scene. They've been Judah all the time. And eventually we come on down to the time of 587, when now Assyria is conquered by the Babylonians. The Babylonians come and conquer Jerusalem and Judah in 587 B.C. There was one dynasty, that is one family, and from this family 20 kings, and that is the line from which Jesus Christ comes. And that's the reason today we can speak about Jesus as being from that line of descent, and we can speak of Jesus as being the king. Christ not only was a prophet, he was a king as well, and a priest. And he brings an end to that line because, of course, he had no children and did not continue on after that. So what we have come down to now is the study of bringing God's people throughout the ages down to a point at which we have a line of descent to whom we're going to find the Messiah coming. We find him coming through Abraham. We find him also coming, as we mentioned last night, through the tribe of Judah. In fact, in the book of Genesis chapter 49, Jacob predicted that the tribe of Judah would be the tribe from which the Messiah would come. So as we turn now from these, we turn to what we know of now as the prophets. Now this brings us down in our study in the Old Testament of the history books. We have many things that I haven't mentioned. For an example, the book of Ruth, a lovely book, happened to the time of the Judges. We come to the time of Esther, a very, very beautiful book about the existence of Israel during the time of the Persians. We could talk about many of those kind of things. It'd be interesting, but of course we don't have time. But that thread of truth we're following brings us down now to the time of about 400 years before Christ. Therefore, when you see this, we notice that Babylon has come to conquer Jerusalem. They are succeeded, as we'll notice in just a moment, by the following world empire, Medo-Persia. And then after them came the Greeks and then the Romans. And the Romans were in power when Christ came on the scene. Now, to find what we're talking about here, we go to the book of Daniel, chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2 now is a book of prophecy. So we leave the Old Testament history, in effect, in the past, because it's brought us all the way down now to where God is going to change his direction to us. Not only is he showing us, and has shown us, the line of descent of the people of God down to the coming of the prophets, but now he brings the prophets on the scene. And during the time of all those kings we saw a while ago, God raised up the prophets. Now, prophets had two missions. One mission was to talk to the people and tell them, you've sinned, you need to turn back to God. Number two was to point to the future and give us information as to how to determine and to locate the Messiah when he came. The prophets served those two purposes. Over and over again, they pointed to things of accusation and condemnation and encouragement, and then they pointed to the future. Now, our real concern right now is the future, because the prophets are going to tell us what to look for and what to expect so we can identify the Messiah when he comes on the scene. Daniel now rises during the time he was taken away from Jerusalem during the invasion of Babylon. He's taken away during a period of time when Israel is, so Jeremiah tells us, chapter 23, that Israel is going to be 70 years as a captive people. He's going to allow them to return in 517, rebuild the temple again, and Jerusalem and Israel are going to be, Judah are going to be there, and they're going to be God's people. They're going to be under the bondage of the Babylonians. So from this time forward, they're under the control of those nations around them that are not God-fearing people. Babylon first, Persia next, Greece next, and Rome next. So they're going to be, for this long period of time, under control of foreign nations. They have rejected God. He allowed them to be conquered and taken under captivity. And so they're going to have to experience these things because they have transgressed the will of God. As we turn now to the book of Daniel chapter 2, the first prophet we're going to look at, he tells us there that, Daniel tells us there that he was in Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar dreams. And these dreams could not be understood by anyone there. He called in those magicians and soothsayers and those men who were able to see the mystical works and things of that kind, and they couldn't tell him what it meant. And so Nebuchadnezzar said, in effect, this is what you say you can do. This is what you are here for. This is your claim. You can't do it. I'm going to kill you. And he proceeded to do that. In the meantime, though, they came to Daniel. Word received by him that all of those who have this ability or supposed ability are going to be killed. Daniel says, these are my words, don't be so hasty. Wait a minute. Because there's a God in heaven that can tell these things. So he was called into Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was to tell him what he dreamed. But Nebuchadnezzar forgot it. He couldn't tell him what it was. So Daniel was able, by God of God, to tell Nebuchadnezzar what he dreamed and what it meant. Here's what he dreamed. He dreamed there was a great image. This image was as of a man. And this body of a man was made up of different kinds of metals, different kinds of minerals that had been put together in such form. We have gold and silver and brass and iron, and the iron mixed with miry clay in the feet. And so this was the picture of the image, and of course, what does that mean? What could it possibly mean? An awful image that has made up of these metals. Well, Daniel explained to him, this is what you dreamed, and this is what you saw, and what you saw is something that will tell us what's going to happen in the future. He said, Nebuchadnezzar, you are this head of gold. And after you, there's going to arise another kingdom which is going to be inferior to you. It's the kingdom of silver. You see, silver is not as valuable as gold. But notice also, silver is stronger than gold. They said, after this kingdom of silver, there's going to arise another kingdom, and this kingdom of brass is going to be superior to all of you in the sense of strength, but not as valuable. Then it comes to the fourth mineral, the iron. Now this is much stronger than all the others, but it's not as valuable. He says, so each of these kingdoms is going to be left to the kingdom before it, so that Babylon should be conquered by Persia, Persia conquered by Greece, Greece conquered by Rome. He says then in verse 44, in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. It'll break in pieces, consume all these kingdoms, and it'll stand forever. Now, Daniel didn't foresee everything that you and I can see in that, because he didn't live long enough to see it. And God didn't tell him everything he'd like to know. In fact, on one occasion, Daniel asked God, let me see more about this. And Daniel, and God said, that's enough. It's for the time of the end. But you and I can see those things now, because the end time has come, and we're able to see more than Daniel did. Not because we're better than Daniel, but because God revealed it to us in the latter part of the Old and New Testaments. What we do find then, in fulfillment of what this dream was, and you can read about this in your world history. I read about it when I was in grade school, and those of you who are probably in 7th or 8th grade, maybe even 9th grade, you read about these things. And strangely enough, the books that you're reading in school are not written by Daniel or by any of God's people necessarily, written by people that don't even believe in God. But they'll tell you precisely what Daniel predicted back in the 500s. And that is, these kingdoms that he just mentioned, I just referred to you, these kingdoms came exactly like the Bible predicted they would come. Now, if anything can prove the Bible to be God's word, it's predictions such as this. What we find then is that this head of gold came on the scene in 606 B.C. This is when Babylon was conquered. Babylon came on the scene, and they conquered the Assyrians just shortly before this time, the Assyrians who had taken away the 10 northern tribes. Now, we're primarily concerned, though, with these four earthly kingdoms, not Assyria because it's passed on, and not Egypt because it's passed on a long time before. So from Daniel's time on down, read these four kingdoms that your history books tell you about. So Babylon then came on the scene, and they were able to conquer Jerusalem in 587. And then in 539, they were conquered by coming on the scene of this kingdom of silver, which is Medo-Persia. Medo-Persia conquered them. Babylon ceases. Persia is the kingdom of the world then, the greatest kingdom, far expanse over what Babylon was. And then in 331, the Greeks came on the scene, and Alexander the Great and his armies, and they conquered the Persians, and they were the world-dominant power at that time until a time of about 168, when Rome came on the scene to conquer the Greeks, and that's where you find things getting to be very, very close to what we need to look at. So we have four kingdoms: Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. In the days of Rome, the God of heaven is going to set up his kingdom. It hadn't happened yet, because Rome has not yet conquered Jerusalem. They're going to do that. They're going to control Jerusalem. And during this period of time is when you're going to find the Messiah come, the kingdom of God set up. But there are other things that need to read and talk about before we determine more in detail about that coming. Now, I need to leave you hanging there tonight, because if I don't, we're going to be involved so much in some other processes that I'll take too much time. You don't want to sit another hour. So we're going to stop there. But let me repeat what we found. We found that God has provided throughout the ages the coming of the things we've talked about now, the prophets. The prophets are going to point for us, as he pointed the people before us, the coming of the Messiah. He's going to tell us when it will happen, where it happened, the circumstances of which it happened. He's going to name the Messiah. He's going to name some things almost impossible to think about being able to be predicted. Even the exact day, the exact year of the death of Christ. He's going to talk to us about a virgin having a child. He's going to talk to us about a little village called Bethlehem, very, very minor village. He's going to talk to us about that. He's going to talk to us about a person riding a donkey back. Just so many things that seem not to be important really until you put them all together. They're a beautiful picture of who Christ is. So we've come down now to Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. We're in Rome, and now we're going to talk about the prophecies that tie in with this and allow us to see more precisely the coming of the Messiah. You've been kind to listen. We appreciate so much you're doing so. And we hope that we've been able to interest you in seeing what the beautiful books of the Bible tell us about God providing for you and me. Things that this world around do not understand and do not know. Many of them don't care about it. But we're fortunate enough, blessed by God enough, to have a book that tells us all these things, gives us a hope. The only hope we could possibly have, I'll leave you in this world for a far better place yet to come. I have just time to sing this hymn. If it might be someone we could aid spiritually, would you let your wish be known by coming forward?